Conference record has joined the conference.
All right. Well, great, everyone. I did hear a couple more beeps, so we're going to go ahead and get started tonight on our topical call on family-centered care and what that means for families that have children with special health care needs. I'm Deneen Feist, and I'll be the presenter for this call. We do have some of the Family Voices staff and some familiar folks that are on the call, so I'm just going to go ahead and get cracking at it. If you have questions along the way, just go ahead and stop me. So I want to make sure that all the questions that you have can be answered. So tonight we're going to be talking about family-centered care, but first I want to talk a little bit about children with special health care needs. Above all, children with special health care needs are children who want to live a happy, healthy childhood. They live in towns, cities, and rural areas and go to school, church, and community events, just like any other regular or general children in the communities. Many of our kids with special health care needs, and when we say special health care needs, we're using that term pretty broadly. So it could be any child that has a physical disability, a chronic health condition, emotional or mental health disabilities, that kind of thing. That's the maternal and child health definition of children with special health care needs. Sometimes when we have encountered families, like on occasion there have been families that may have had a child with Down syndrome or a child with even spina bifida, and they never really considered that they were a child with special health care needs. So I wanted to make sure to clarify some of that terminology a little bit. Some of our kids might have a brief but life-threatening medical problem. Others may only need an accurate diagnosis, and then some may need treatment, medication, or technology. We know that children with special health care needs in the United States really have a wide variety of service delivery systems in the public sector and in the private sector. In North Dakota, we have about 20,000 children with special health care needs in the state. And according to the last survey that was done by the Maternal and Child Health Bureau, that breaks out nationally at about 2% or 20.2% for 0 to 5-year-olds, 38% for 6 to 11-year-olds, and 12 to 17-year-olds is about 41%. So that's kind of how it breaks out. There's approximately 11.2 million children with special health care needs in the United States, which represents 1 in 5 households. Our data in North Dakota also represents, from the National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs, that also came out as having a 1 in 5 ratio, of 1 in 5 household ratio in North Dakota. So we kind of mirror the national information as well. So most of you know what Family Voices does, so I'm going to skip a little bit of part of that, but we are a state affiliate organization from the national organization. We are set up as a health information and education center for families and professionals to provide information and resources on health care, disability, chronic health illnesses, anything that's going to affect a child with special health care needs. We are one of 50 health information and education centers across the country. Those were set up through federal money. Originally, it came out of the Deficit Reduction Act when President Bush was in office. And then over time, that money has shifted a little bit and it is going to shift again. So we have to go through a reauthorization process and rewrite the grants, that kind of thing. But there is one of us in every state. So if you know families that are moving from here to another state, please let us know so that we can connect them with a family organization in the state that they may be moving to. So just a little bit about Family Voices. We do have the North Dakota Parent-to-Parent Program. We have a parent navigator teams across the state, which is in Fargo, they do have one, because I'm mentioning Fargo because I know that there are several of you on the call from Fargo. And those groups are to kind of identify and fill in gaps. So if they see a need, it's something that the group, if they collaboratively want to work on that, and we will help them provide with some technical support. The other program that we have in partnership with Designer Genes, which is a Down syndrome support network in Bismarck, and Pathfinder Family Center, we collaborated on a project called Project Carson. Project Carson is a program that if a family gets a prenatal or at-birth diagnosis, that we can provide that support, that parent-to-parent support to them prenatally, and then if it's an at-birth diagnosis. So we'll help them, our staff will help them get connected with the resources that may be available, another parent, that kind of thing. I'm hoping that all of you got the slides that I sent out, and Megan, I know you're traveling, so you'll probably see those when you go home. But on our slide 8, there is a very nice picture of maybe some of all the service systems that one family has had to encounter. So as you can see, from clinical directors to the schools to estate planning to support services, families often encounter quite a few different disciplines and providers. So it can get to be very complex for families. So understanding some common issues is, in addition to all of the providers a family may have to deal with, there are many additional issues that they may be dealing with. So for a family, they may also be dealing with some financial issues, qualifying for programs, co-pays and premiums. They may be a one-wage earner for the family. They may not, their savings may not be there. They have to worry about what assets they have, forms, and more forms that families have to get filled out, and it often is quite frustrating for families. Another thing that families have to deal with oftentimes is in their marital relationships. Oftentimes, when you have a child with special health care needs, your time gets built up quite a bit around your family circle. So oftentimes the marital relationship will suffer a little because there's no time for each other. Communication may not be where it needs to be. Sometimes there might be some blaming that goes on back and forth. Coping strategies and acceptance differ. I know when our son was initially diagnosed, my husband Richard, his coping strategies were much different than mine, and he probably was in acceptance much later than I came to terms with it too. So sometimes there may be also it can make or break a relationship. The best advice that one of the doctors ever gave me was to make a point to have at least one date night a week with your husband. And even though that never happened, it was pretty good advice, but I'm just sharing that with you. for some siblings, there might be some unintentional neglect because the focus is on this child with special health care needs, and that may fluctuate depending upon the health condition of that child. They may have to give up some of the normal that they had felt or as part of that family unit before. There may be some jealousy, some anger, some hurt. And I had hate down there. That's a strong word, and I don't always like to use that. There may be some other health issues, and siblings may have some embarrassment of their sibling with special health care needs. So these are all some factors that happen within the context of the family. They also might be some extended family members, grandparents that may be, so there's some double grief there. Other families may not understand what's happening with the child with special health care needs. They may not understand the diagnosis, that kind of thing. And then if I can't get my, you know, some families come out feeling like if I can't get my family to understand that he has a disability and that it's not bad parenting or my fault, how will anybody else understand? And so some of those dynamics come into play as well. I know early on when Zach was initially diagnosed, I think it was, on my dad, it was very, very difficult for him to even accept. And I felt, and maybe it was more me than anything, but I always felt like there was a little bit of avoidance with communication and interacting with our son that had that's got a very profound hearing impairment. So I think until everybody got adapted to the new life situation, it made it a little bit difficult. Sometimes families even have troubles with some of their friends that they've had forever. Sometimes the interests become different. Friends may feel guilty, quite honestly, that they have these, the quote, normal, or children that, I don't want to say normal, but children that are not affected by a health condition or a disability. They may stop calling. They have a difficult time understanding what we may have be going through. And, you know, a lot of times they just may not want to hear about it anymore. So I just had a couple little analogies there that I quoted from that others have shared with us as we've been going forward on different things that people have said. So I just put those down there as well. A lot of times families will feel initially and even periodically throughout the time of raising their children that they may feel like they're isolated, that they're all alone, that no one understands. They don't enjoy some of the old interests that they had and get annoyed with those that are seen as, quote, general or normal. Routines change dramatically. You may never get back the normal routine that you had prior. Sometimes families feel stuck, unable to go out, and, again, isolated. For some families, you know, again, they may feel like it was a successful day, just getting out of bed and getting in the shower. So, you know, everybody has bad days like that. And so we are always here to help support families no matter what phase that they may be going through. Vacations, a lot of families, mine included, may not be able to get a vacation. They aren't something that's real easy to come by. It takes a lot of arranging to make that happened for an entire family, and because of the child with special health care needs, there may not be always the money available to go on vacation, so, or they may feel guilty if they leave their child, and for some it's just way too hard to go on a vacation type thing. Some of the other things that may happen is some social stigmas for families that may end up having to utilize some of the public services like medical assistance, that kind of thing. There's, you know, sometimes there's some fear there of the stigma of being on the welfare system. North Dakota is pretty notorious about having the mentality of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and we're going to keep moving forward. A lot of times families don't even want to ask for public health help at all. And for some, the disabled and sick are seen as a burden. So there are some social stigmas that come as well. Another area that I wanted to bring up that may cause some problems for families is some spiritual and religious type of issues that can come up. Sometimes people will walk away from their beliefs and comforts, and sometimes the spiritual and religious type things become more meaningful for them. But in they still not wanting to ask for help. So, you know, that is also an area where sometimes families struggle. One thing to think about is that life is going to be changing with a child with special health care needs, but it doesn't mean that you don't have to stop dreaming. So essentially, we want you to look at building new dreams, finding happiness in new ways of life, a deeper appreciation for things, and you'll find that the little things are no longer taken for granted. Some folks will find themselves in new relationships, building friendships and support around a new world in dreams. And, you know, the professionals become partners in our children's care and future. So many of those providers that are working with our children often become, some become very good friends. Another issue that does come up for families is jobs. Their job may not understand the amount of time off that's needed. There may be some concerns of insurance. Co-workers might have some frustrations because of the amount of time that people are gone. So families face a lot of stressors when they have a child with special health care needs. And often we don't always think about those stressors. Another thing is some reoccurring grief. Excuse me. When our kids are transitioning, oftentimes they may start off with a group of kids in a class, and they may end up falling behind. So when those transitions happen, and our children are not transitioning with others that are their age of peers. That could be difficult. I know one of the biggest things that was really difficult for me was when they would have Christmas concerts, and I knew that all the kids were singing and blaring and everything, and Zach stood on the stage and had this blank expression on his face and would move his lips, but I knew that it wasn't happening. So that sometimes those were kind of hard for me. Some milestones, maybe a graduation or a wedding, those kind of things might cause some reoccurring grief. And sometimes families may have some reoccurring grief for no reason at all. Something just will trigger it, and you become anxious and feeling that grief again. A lot of times families will experience some burnout because it's a 24/7 job. There's a lot of red tape. I've always said that the biggest barrier for having a child with a disability or a chronic health illness is sometimes you encounter some fairly ignorant people, and they may say some things that make you really question. You may have a lack of care for oneself, a feeling of defeat, and have to work very hard to keep balance. So families do burn out quite frequently, and that's kind of a normal thing. The other thing, thing that families have to face is their typical activities that they used to do may not be occurring. Relationships may be changing, activities may be changing, so there's a lot of sacrifice that comes. But families who raise children with special health care needs often sacrifice the ease and comfort many people believe life should bring them. But the definition of sacrifice is to give up one thing in exchange for something better. And I just wanted to make sure that quote was there. Families are really unique and have their own culture. Families' wants, needs, and desires are really dependent upon the information, trust, compassion, respect, and empowerment services that they receive. So the more we can educate on some of the things that are happening with families and then on the services, I really feel like the more information that we can feed families, the better that they are to make informed decisions. So kind of moving on to family-centered care, I just wanted to make sure that we talked a little bit about some of the things that families face that can be hardships, but that there's always a light at the end of the tunnel. So some of those key elements of family-centered care and I'm going to run through these fairly quickly. The first one is that recognizing that the family is the constant in the child's life while the service systems and the personnel within those systems fluctuate. And we'll talk a little bit about these as we move forward. The next one is making sure that there is facilitation of parent-professional collaboration at all levels of healthcare, the care of the individual child, program development, implementation, evaluation, and policy formation. Family Voices National has developed a very nice family-centered care tool, and you can find, if you can't find it, it's on the Family Voices National website. If anyone's interested in that tool, I think at the end of this of the slides is a link to that tool. There is a tool there for families, and there's a tool there for providers. Providers can take that tool to look at how family-centered their services are within their affiliate or structure, and families can also take that tool to identify the services that they receive. Are they really family-centered? So that's another tool that is out there and available, and we'll talk more about that. Family-centered care also honors the racial, ethnic, and cultural, social, economic diversity of families, recognizing family strengths and individuality, respecting different methods of coping, and sharing with parents on a continuing basis and in a supportive manner, complete and unbiased information. I really want to stress sharing with parents that complete and unbiased information. I cannot tell you how many phone calls we have received over the years where, for an example, maybe a provider told them about the slice of bread but not the loaf of bread. And so when the family finds out that there may have been other services available, there ends up being a little bit of animosity because why were they never told that before? But in many of the providers' defense, a lot of times providers don't know what other services may be out there. They've been, they're focused around the services that they provide. So that's why we have always been encouraged to have providers make sure that they are connecting families for that family support, because there may be other services out there that the family may be able to access. Another element of family-centered care is encouraging and facilitating that family-to-family support or that parent-to-parent networking. And then understanding and incorporating the developmental needs of infants, children, and adolescents and their families into that healthcare system. That's another real important one as well. I'm on slide 31, in case you wondered, because I'm going pretty fast. Another element is implementing comprehensive policies and programs that provide emotional and financial support to meet the needs of families, and we'll talk more about that. And designing accessible healthcare systems that are flexible, culturally competent, and responsive to identified needs. The Red Turnbull from the Beach Center, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Beach Center, but it is it's the university affiliated program, they call it the USED in Kansas. And Red Turnbull has been really one of, a real prominent disability advocate across the country, but he put it this way that family-centered care is much like the Copernican Revolution, which put the sun rather than the earth at the center of the universe, causing a profound challenge to the conceptualization of the universe. So which family-centered care is very similar, where the family is that center of that universe rather than the service system being at the center of that universe. So that's where we're going to focus on now, is that the family is at the center. So families of children with special health care needs, really families are those primary caregivers and advocates for their children, and then all of the family becomes involved with coping and caretaking required when they have a child with special needs. So really a family is at its best when it meets the family member's needs sufficiently for the family member to grow and develop. So, and then how do we get there? So families and the service systems. Children with special needs bring caregivers and service providers together over long periods of time. So for this reason, it really is imperative to work together in a collaborative manner. Family-centered care started in the early 80s with a group of healthcare professionals and families called for change, recognizing the importance and impact of the family perspective. The family-centered care philosophy blossomed and evolved, and that's part of the reason that Family Voices took off in the beginning, especially with the Maternal and Child Health Bureau, is because those groups came together and they really wanted to identify what are the philosophy that, what is going to be the core that is going to help us to help families. So that's where Family Voices National, many years ago, kind of, those were some of the founding pieces of Family Voices National. So family-centered care really is based on the belief that all families care deeply and want to nurture and support their children. It's a fundamental element of family-centered care is really that family involvement piece. It's a process and not a destination, and we always encourage providers at all kinds of levels, whether it be at the clinic, at the hospital, like the Human Service Center, to make sure that when you're looking at your service delivery, that families are involved in many of those processes, from starting a program, looking at policies, changing the program. We encourage many of the providers that we work with to have a family advisory council to get that feedback from families on a continual basis. So if we want to look at who the family is, Polly Arango, who is my, she was the director of Family Voices National for many, many years, and she was my mentor. She described families as this, is that families are big, small, extended, nuclear, multi-generational. They might, with one parent, two parents, and grandparents. We live under one roof or many. A family can be as temporary as a few weeks, as permanent as forever. We can be a part of a family by birth, adoption, marriage, or from a desire for mutual support. A family is a culture unto itself with different values and unique ways of realizing dreams. Together, our families become the source of our rich culture, heritage, and spiritual diversity. Our families create neighborhoods, communities, states, and nations. So that was her definition of what families are, and something that we've always taken on as our mantra is what is that family and what does those family dynamics look like? And as you can see, it's very, very diverse. So on slide 38, I just put this up. I included this slide for you all because when this slide particularly comes from one of the medical home projects. When families were asked to identify what were their priorities, you can see families were asked and physicians were asked to rate the priorities of which they felt would meet their needs. And if you look at slide 38, you can see that for physicians, they thought that respite care was the biggest priority. But if you look at what parents wanted, community resources was their biggest priority. For parents, it was community resources, financial information, and parent support groups. For physicians, they thought it was respite care, daycare, and parent support. So you can see just with that alone, you can see that the different philosophies and I think this is an important slide. So, and I think it's that way with many providers. They may think that families want something, but when it comes right down to it, these are how families scored what they wanted to see happen. So I think that's important for providers to kind of think that way. So what families want depends on the difference between the support they already have and what they will need given their situation. So family-centered care is really a best practice. Families are involved in decision-making. They're more satisfied with their primary care provider or the professionals that they work with. And if families are active in developing a care plan or more or that type of thing, they're more likely to follow and maintain that care plan if they are a part of it. So how do we establish a collaborative partnership with families and families of children, and children with special health care needs? My slides went amok on me, so I had to find my way back. It really takes a lot of family professional collaboration, one that promotes a relationship in which the family and the professional work together to ensure the best service for the child and family, and recognizes and respects the knowledge and skills that families and professionals bring to that relationship. And it also acknowledges that the development of trust is an integral part of a collaborative relationship. We had a woman several years ago that came to North Dakota to do a presentation on family professional collaboration, and her analogy was something that really has stuck with me for forever, because I feel like I've been doing this now forever. But she had her presentation was called "The Dance of Partnership: Why Do My Feet Hurt So Much?" And basically, in a nutshell, it's because the families come and they may have their agenda. Providers come, they may have their agenda. Sometimes they're not always gelling together. We may walk on each other's toes when we're doing the two-step or the cha-cha, but with good communication, that collaboration can expand and broaden. So I hope we all think of it in those terms, that dance is not always, it's not always immediate. Sometimes it takes some practice. And but the result is a wonderful thing. So to further talk about some of that family professional collaboration, really it facilitates open communication so that families and professionals feel free to express themselves. It creates an atmosphere in which the cultural traditions, the values, diversity of families are honored and acknowledged, and recognizes that negotiation is essential. I always say to, when I hear you can't, I always like to go to, well, then how can we? How do we get there? It also includes acknowledgement of mutual respect for each other's cultures and values. There went my slides again. Doggone it. So how do we create these family professional, family-centered atmosphere. One thing is you know, like for maybe for some facilities, is that they can have families fill out intake forms while in the waiting room to assess their concerns and needs, or put a suggestion box in that waiting room, make sure the office setting is reflective of the various cultures and traditions that families honor, those types of things. Look at the facility and look at the surrounding. Is it family friendly? Is it family focused? Is there room for feedback from others so that if something isn't going right, that they may be able to change those things? So speak to the family directly using his or her name. Ask if they have questions at the beginning and the end of each visit. Just that very good communication is so vital. I think for professionals to make sure that there's adequate time when they're doing scheduling, children with special health care needs often take a longer amount of time, so that there's time to communicate with the families, and I think that's really important. Many of our health care systems are set up that in those 15-minute increments, and sometimes those just aren't long enough. They may want written information from the office to families and to make sure that it's written in family-friendly language. And again, if possible, construct a family advisory group for the practice. So, again, going back to some of the principles of family-centered care is incorporating into policy and practice the recognition that the family is the constant. They're responsible for the health, physical, and emotional needs of the family. So how do we make sure that we're getting good enough feedback from families to make sure that they feel like everything that they are dealing with is being focused on in that realm of that family? Some service providers and health professionals may participate intensely and meaningfully in the lives of children with special health care needs, but again, the families provide that long-term relationship. So families will often be the ones that decide the options that are consistent with the values of their family culture and what's in the best interest of their child. So again, making an informed decision can't be made if families are only provided with part of the information that they're going to need. And I think that is a huge piece to our family-centered care. So some examples of that may be acknowledge who the key family members are, ask families what they value, what are their routines, recognize the expertise of the family and listen to their ideas and opinions. For an example, is that therapy goal too much for the family at this time? One of the biggest things that was really an issue for us is we had all kinds of people coming into our house, and we had this therapy to do and that therapy to do, and we had to run to Fargo to do a lot of them, but not one person asked if it was too much. And at some point, I felt like I was going to explode because I didn't know how I was going to get it all done. So it's really important for families to be honest when they're feeling overwhelmed and that it may be too much. And it's also important for the providers to ask. Another one would be the office appointment within a time frame to allow as little absence of work as possible. For many of our families, financially we struggle. So can we have that appointment at the end of the day, so that we don't have to take that much time off work? Has the family been able to provide input into any goals and objectives that are needed for the child? For providers, have they incorporated input from families regarding dietary likes, dislikes, level of pain, nap periods, those types of things? The more information that we can get from families will also help improve the care for that child. So include the family's input as much as possible for the care of the child. And if they're not included in that process, really their disapproval is frequently demonstrated by not being compliant. And I think I want to make sure that we stress that. And then what are the family dynamics and culture that need to be incorporated? Maybe mom is coming to all the appointments because dad is working two jobs, or, there's all kinds of dynamics that you could think about there. So principle two is incorporating and facilitating that family professional collaboration at all levels of care. So for the care of the individual child, program development, implementation, and policy information. So some examples of that might be listen to families and follow their lead. I think that some of the best resources have been from other families. Families are very frugal, I think, with some of the, they've had to be frugal. They often don't recognize how important their role is. I think it's important that we build confidence in families and tell them often what they do and what they do well. I think sometimes families feel so intimidated by the services that they don't always feel like they can ask questions. They may feel intimidated, so we really need to support families in their role as an advocate as well. Families and service providers really do share in those aspects of care for the child, but families that are involved in that full range of healthcare delivery as planners and evaluators really do a remarkable job. So we really need to include families as often as possible. Families are really fully participatory in the decision-making process and share responsibilities, while professionals serve as coaches, information providers, and enablers of the meaningful participation of families. Providing information in an understandable format will well in advance, if possible, for any decision-making deadline is also very helpful for families. Sometimes we have to think about, I know I do, when when something new was coming at me with Zach, I really had to have some of that material ahead of time so I could think about what my answers were going to be. Or even ask following the appointment. Families need a little bit of time sometimes just to sort through the thoughts that they're having so that they can communicate well back with the providers. So fully presenting all options, complications, any projected outcomes, allowing families to add observations to maybe some documents that in the hospital, that kind of thing, allow families to add what they're seeing as well, because they may be sitting with that family or that child in the hospital or whatever the case may be. Include families at the policy level, such as, again, advisory boards, strategic planning. I know a lot of the hospitals now are starting with family advisory boards. Some of the service systems are asking families to be part of their advisory boards. It's a great thing to have families at that level be able to provide their input, because essentially they are the ones that are receiving the services. Families can help other staff in implementation of family-centered care. That happens quite frequently. So now moving on to Principle 3, is slide 54, is sharing with parents a continuous and biased, a continuing basis and in supporting manner, complete and unbiased information. So again, encouraging families to write down their information, questions, suggestions before a visit. Avoid making assumptions. Another one is speaking in jargon. A lot of families haven't been exposed to the jargon. They're not going to know what a PPP is or you know, some of the language that may be shared amongst your coworkers or other staff. They may not know what those acronyms are. So try not to speak in jargon. Offer opinions, but be sure that the family understands all of the options that are available to them. Repeat critical information and expectations and next steps. I know there was many times when I would be overwhelmed with the information that was given to us on a pretty regular basis, but I would get overwhelmed with that, and at times it would feel like, oh, how do I want to explain that? When you watch Charlie Brown and you hear that, when you hear the teacher in the background with the wah, 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 I would literally see people's lips moving but not be able to comprehend what they were saying because my brain was just too full and too overwhelmed. So really it is really critical sometimes to have to repeat that information. Don't expect that families are always going to be able to understand it the first time. So some examples of Principle 3 is knowledge eliminates feeling of powerlessness and dependence. So again, access to information needs to be understandable, free of jargon, current and complete. Parents often relate to us that the more they know, the less scary the future looks. And we've heard that from many, many, many families. So invite questions and expressions of concern. Provide written information, videotapes, audio tapes, illustrations as a possible backup if needed. Be available for follow-up discussions. Again, schedule adequate time to talk with the family. Make sure that there's some privacy that the family can encounter. Suggest families contact a family resource center in the community or a local hospital that may be able to help. Some other examples might be information exchange. That might be vital over days, months, and years. Sometimes, you know, families may need that follow-up. We can't assume that families have everything that they need, and we can't assume that because they're not asking questions that they don't need to hear what the provider needs to tell them again. We just can't make assumptions. So the best thing that I could say about family-centered care, it comes down to darn good communication. Families really do need a lot of time, privacy, support, and the opportunity to grieve the loss of the dream that they once had. The dream has shifted, so they need that time to be able to process. They also need this time to formulate questions and process the information that was provided to them. Again, like I said, a lot of times when I was overwhelmed, I would see lips moving and nothing was comprehending to me anymore. So moving on to principle 4 is honoring the racial, ethnic, cultural, and socioeconomic diversity of families. So we really need to understand cultures without stereotyping, and we need to define the family composition and understand the roles of family members. So some of those examples is we really need to learn about various cultures. For an example, I used to live in Okinawa, Japan, and whatever the elders said, that's what the family did. So we have to be aware of our own values and beliefs and how they help shape your actions and decisions. Respect family values and beliefs. Be non-judgmental. Traditional white Anglo families are composed of mother, father, and siblings. Asian, Hispanic families will include the grandparents, the cousins, the uncles, the aunts. And when I lived in Okinawa, there was many times that there might have been 15-plus people under one roof because people were living together. The hierarchy within families may vary quite a bit. So it's important to know those dynamics. Some other things may include birth, death, divorce, marriage, and changes in the socioeconomic status. All of those will need good communication. And if necessary, you may need an interpreter. They may have other speak in another language, or they may be deaf or hard of hearing, and they may need a sign language interpreter. But we must embrace the culture of people. So consider ways to sensitize the entire office staff or others about the diversity of families. Provide educational materials in multiple languages that are needed, often translation and interpreter services. We are able to access if needed for other languages, but I think we could do a better job ourselves to be able to have some of our materials and things in multiple languages. Decorate the office to reflect cultural diversity. We are not an Anglo state any longer, so we need to make sure that we're reflecting everybody as a community that are in our communities embrace everybody. And then we also need to recognize what nonverbal behaviors are communicating to the family and vice versa. Oftentimes families that it may be part of their culture, but in the way that they express themselves may not know that they're coming off as being maybe brass, for an example. In some cultures, eye contact and shyness are part of that culture. So we need to understand that as well. A family may have religious beliefs that are not the same as ours, but we still need to be respectful of their culture, of their family. And their dynamics, the family dynamics. Each family carries within them their own traditions, and no two families are the same. So up here in the Northland, for an example, at one time when it was opening deer season, a lot of people took their kids out of school so that their kids could go to deer hunt with mom and dad. Well, you may not see that in another state, that kind of thing. So we have to, traditional type family things, no two families are the same, and we need to be very cautious of how we impose our beliefs onto others. So principle 5 of family-centered care is recognizing those strengths and individuality. Identify strengths, their communication, their knowledge, their parenting style, support systems, and culture. So ask families, what are your strengths? What are your concerns? What are your child's likes? What are their dislikes? What is the best way to approach your child? What would you like to see happen? What do you need? What has worked in the past? What is working now? What are your needs in your current situation? And from that, develop a plan of care to build on family strengths. Families often have responsibilities for meeting the needs in areas such as economics, again, personal, physical, domestic, self-definition, educational. Families of children with special health care needs have needs that go far beyond the medical arena. The educational arena, I mean, they are, again, if you go back to some of the previous slides, you'll see that they are encountering a whole lot of service providers. So we need to make sure that all of those needs are being met for families. It is important, really, again, to recognize the range of emotions in coping, too. Some families have a lot of fear. They have a lot of anger, confusion. Some may be agitated. There may be some sadness, some isolation. I know that when Zach was first diagnosed, I was one angry mom. I was really, really ticked off. I was ticked off at the world, and I didn't even realize that I was even, that in all my encounters with other people, I didn't realize how angry I was coming off to them just from being angry about this new life that we had, that I wasn't ready for it. I was scared. We didn't have money. So, you know, all those things come into play. So family-centered care really offers an alternative to that powerlessness. Okay. Equally important is to understand that no two families are the same, nor are family members in the same family the same. So above all, if there is anger, don't feel like this is personally directed at anybody. It's part of the coping process. Families and parents arrive with different levels of preparedness, and professionals really need to be able to recognize and assist in addressing those situations. Sometimes when I have seen reports, even in my own reports, some of the physicians may have written in Zach's chart, "Mom is an overreactive mom." Really be careful about what you say to coworkers, what professionals write in charts. What you perceive to be happening may not be the full picture. So I hope that professionals are able to recognize and assist in addressing various situations. So a parent can be temporarily paralyzed by their child's crisis, and some may be well prepared, but above all, it is so important not to make assumptions about what may be happening with that family if you don't know. Those assumptions really get a lot of us into trouble sometimes. So, needs are ever-changing over time. So family-centered policies would develop programs to bridge the gaps between the child's needs, the family's needs, and the available services. What one family can accept, another one may have much difficulty with. So really be sensitive to each other, sensitive in the communication with families. And I just gave that as an example because it's one that has been kind of a thorn for me, is when somebody would say to me, "God doesn't give you more than you can handle." Well, that isn't always the right thing to say to a family member, because in some instances, the family is having enough guilt for having a child with special health care needs. There may be other family dynamics going on. Mom and dad might be getting, looking at a separation. Finances may be hitting the bottom. Another family member may be diagnosed with a severe illness, and everything seems like it's going to hell at once. It's just really an insensitive thing. So I think we really have to think about all of our communication that we do. Principle 6 was encouraging and facilitating family-to-family support and networking. So we really need to be sensitive to the family's needs and what they need for support. Some families may not want that parent-to-parent support. Some of them may just want, they want that initial contact and they don't want anything else. So we have to be able to measure all the time where families are at. And unless we have that good communication, we are not going to be able to measure that. So we need to validate the value of family-to-family support. I know for me, I'm very biased about that. I really feel like if a family was newly diagnosed, one of the first things that should happen is that they can get connected to a family organization, whether it be the Federation of Families for Children's Mental Health, Family Voices, Pathfinder is one of the support groups, but get them connected to some kind of support. Provide information about resources for them. Be informed about area support groups and or encourage families to create support groups if possible. And if you may be a provider that don't know what those resources are, let us know and we will help you find them. Recognize that the child's need for support. The child may also have, they may also want to meet other kids that have a similar diagnosis, but they also need support. And then recognize the support needs of other family members, the grandparents, the siblings. My husband, I mean, like for an example, I told you earlier that he accepted things much differently than what I did. And the first time that I finally felt like he embraced it all was at one of Zach's first school meetings after infant development, and my husband sat in that room and cried, and he had to get up and leave. And then I knew at that moment, that's the moment he finally got it. And I was so relieved, so very relieved at that meeting. So, and that was probably, you know, a year and a half after we had gotten the initial diagnosis. So everybody does things at a different pace. Family-to-family or parent-to-parent support is unique and different from the support provided by professionals. Families want to hear from other families who have been there, who've done it, who've walked it, and maybe have some very, you know, unique tools that will help other families. Emotional issues, our families are traditionally not dealt with in health systems, quite honestly. So, again, that family-to-family or parent-to-parent support can assist professionals in that area as well. Families offer friendships, respect, empathy. That peer-to-peer or the parent-to-parent, peer-to-peer relationships are vital from day one of diagnosis, and I'm a firm believer in that. Through the parent-to-parent or family-to-family connections, relationships can become formal, informal, informational, or disease-specific. We've matched families on, connected families if they had a child that was going to have a surgery to speak to another family that had a similar surgery, or they were going to be trying a new medication. We've connected families that way. So there is a wide variety of ways to connect families to one another. So if in doubt, just give us a call. So there is the number for the parent-to-parent program. So then, moving then on to Principle 7 is really understanding and incorporating the developmental needs of children and adolescents. So we need to make sure that we're asking questions about developmental issues, listening for families' concerns, conducting developmental screenings if needed, assist families to understand and support the developmental needs of children. Sometimes families may not know, so as much as we can provide families those developmental milestones type of things so that families can understand and look at the developmental needs of their children, make referrals to the developmental specialists and support services, and become informed about the special education programs and services that are out there is really important for families. We want to make certain that treatment is adapted and adjusted for the developmental stages of children. And again, encourage that family advocacy, encourage families to model self-advocacy skills for their child. I think that's really important, and I don't know that we always do a good enough job of that. I thought that I was doing a really good job of teaching Zach some self-advocacy skills, but as he's transitioned into adulthood, I had some, as long as I've been doing this, there were some things that were missing. So, to be ready for that, to help as they're transitioning into adulthood, that there is going to be some, you know, some additional needs. And then design office space and your surroundings to accommodate the developmental needs of children and plan for and support those developmental transitions. One thing is addressing areas of need as the child transitions into adulthood. That's huge. So family-centered care really incorporates that parent input from the beginning of the diagnosis all through across the lifespan. So again, put families on advisory boards, policymaking, have family structure surveys that you may want to get input from others. So each of these examples, family input embraces a partnership that is ongoing and interactive. Negative input can be a valuable opportunity. So if you're a service provider and you're hearing maybe some negative input, maybe the question is, well, how do we turn that around and make that better? And then ask those families, okay, if this is what's happening, what is it that's going to make that better for you? Because if it's going to make it better for one, it might make it better for 15 others. So that communication, again, is really vital. Again, Principle 8 is implementing comprehensive policies and programs that provide emotional and financial support to families. And this comes from the increase in coordination and management with agencies and families. So some ask families, again, what they need. Maybe a checklist would be helpful. Inform families of available programs and resources. Keep brochures and applications on hand. Develop a resource library that would be helpful for families. Again, a parent advisory group to help design. So for the families out there that are on the call, maybe, you know, if you are wanting to be part of some family advisory committees, that kind of thing, that could help shape how service delivery happens to make it more conducive to other families, let us know and we can try to help you get involved in other ways that we can embrace family-centered care together. It's shifting from a child-centered focus to the needs of the entire family. So supporting families beyond the identity of having a child with special needs. The child is not her disability, but really is unique with individual needs, as is the family. And then Principle 9 was designing the healthcare system to be flexible, culturally competent, and responsive to family needs. So this is to say together that families and professionals can design a system that really removes barriers physically and emotionally that meet the needs of everybody. So, again, the flexible hours, evening hours, weekend hours, transportation needs really needs to be considered for families. Some may not have access to vehicles to get long distance, that kind of thing. And trying to help families eliminate financial barriers to the greatest extent possible, connecting them to other services, flexible payment options, that kind of thing. Use community-based care coordination services to help families that need those community-based services. And then some closing examples is that family members serve on, like I said, a wide variety of committees and policy-changing type things. And if families are interested in that, please let us know so that a lot of times providers are always looking for family advisory committees. And we have a database that if families are interested, we've kept their name available so that if a service provider calls that we have an access to families that are interested in those kind of things. Provide in-service opportunities where families assist in trainings. I think it's real important, and if there's families out there that would like to help us at Family Voices do in-service trainings or that kind of thing, we will gladly take other families along with us. Or a lot of times we've also encouraged that if a provider is doing an in-service training regarding a child with, or, you know, something regarding disability or children with special health care needs, bring a family in as a co-presenter. I think a lot of times service providers get a lot of information out of the experiences of families. So another example might be a child life specialist or staff can be assigned to a child and family before a hospital admission, or increase opportunities for a relationship for families who have to stay for lengthy stays. We've had many families that have spent a good deal amount of time at the Ronald McDonald House that becomes their home. Families can assist with also with reviewing of written materials or in the development of new materials. Pull families in, get their opinions. That is really what family-centered care is all about. Encourage family participation through the family liaisons in many areas like the neonatal intensive care unit, other clinics and service providers, etc. There may be a medical library that a family could use as a resource library or assist families to in making a call to agencies like Family Voices to get and get permission to call for them to make that referral. Meet as a team, including the family, to develop and coordinate follow-up care. It's really important. I know, you know, it's really important to have families at those team meetings and discussing what's going to be important, especially if they're like a hospital discharge. What is it that they're going to need? Pre-admission forms for children with special health care needs, which enable the staff to learn about the family, about a child's care and their concerns. We have some very unique forms. We have a care notebook, those kind of things for families that are on our website that are available for families and providers, provide access to children's charts. I think that was one that there were several facilities that were looking at allowing families to have access to those charts. Not all of the hospitals do that. Allow adequate time for if they're going to be hospitalized or that kind of thing so that their brothers and sisters can come in and spend some time with them. Allow families to assist in co-instructive in curriculums for professionals. Megan, you said you were taking some classes at Minot State. You know, if there is an opportunity, I think they would be more than happy to have you help out as a co-instructor or that kind of thing with your expertise as a parent. Family members really Definitely. Provide hands-on community experiences for health professionals in training. So there are several that will do in-services and bring in a family, but I would like to see that increased across all disciplines so that families are providing that input. And then we also want to provide a variety of ways to gather input for families, like questionnaires, evaluation, phone interviews, parent advisories, again, that kind of thing. So on slide 77, you'll see we have a tendency to the family – and this, and Megan, because I know you're on the road, families are at the center. So this, you can see they're in the heart. Then the next yellow ring is that local and community support, and then state, and the blue ring is the national and systems change. But a lot of times what happens is we'll find a family that's in that heart-shaped ring. But we want, there may be somebody that wants them on a state committee, but we haven't done the work in between. We want them to be their inner ring family, but we want them to do outer ring type advisory things, but we haven't done a good job of preparing that family for that role. So we want family-centered care to be very effective so that when those families are coming for those and volunteering for those positions, those advisory committee positions, we want them to have that basis of why family-centered care is important in that inner ring, because policies at the state, local, and national level will affect those families in that inner ring. So we want to do everything that we can do to prepare those families to be in those leadership roles. So a couple things to ponder is that from the moment the family walks into a facility, emergency care, or if you have a home visit, the communication expressed can either make or break that day's encounter. So family-centered care moves us from a prescriptive attitude to a collaborative one. And an important step in developing this collaboration is really seeking information regarding their preferences, opinions, and suggestions about the child's care. And we really need to be cautious of labels such as non-compliant, oppositional, difficult, overreactive, or fragile. Family-centered...
Can you hear me?
Yeah?
Okay, sorry, I didn't know if I went off mute or not. This is Megan, I'm at my destination, so...
Okay.
Thank you.
We're on the last slide, Megan.
Okay.
Okay, so, again, on slide 82 is that link to the tools that, for the family-centered care tools that were designed from Family Voices, and then the last slide is just how to get in touch with us. But family-centered care really was the preemptive to medical home. So it's a best practice, and it's like I said, it's a journey. It's not the destination. So family-centered care came before medical home. Medical home takes family-centered care to the next level. So does anybody, I rattled off really fast. Does anybody have any questions? Or comments? Mary? Megan? Anyone? Joan?
I'm good. Did a good job.
Yeah, you did a really good job. One comment I had is just from a parent point of view is there was a lot, you know, you talked a lot about how overwhelmed as a parent you become.
Yeah.
And I've definitely become overwhelmed as a parent, and it's interesting that I've never had anybody at any of the appointments I've been to with any of my three kids out of the four who have some kind of special needs ask me, how are you doing? Do you need help? What can we do to make this easier for you? Or how can we, you know, condense services or do some things that you're not as overwhelmed?
Yeah, it's important. And I think the first time that I was asked that question, I burst into tears because finally somebody had asked me. I think in some respects it's because disciplines, I mean, they are so swamped. In the provider's defense, they are so swamped with, they are also being asked to do more and more and more with less and less and less. Similar to the parent organizations, but nonetheless, you know, the bottom line is really that good communication. And it ended up that the woman that asked me that, she, initially she was not my favorite person, but we ended up being very, very, very good friends. And I don't know if it's because she was the one that asked me, or, you know, is there anything that we can help with, anything that we can do, how are you? I think maybe it was that little break of communication that made the difference. I don't know, but I'm in my mind that's what it was.
Yep.
So. And I think it's important as family members too to kind of, I mean, at some point we need to feel free to be able to express that. And some are going to be able to do that and some may not. So that's why we want to make sure that we get a lot of information out there on family-centered care and what does that really mean? So that maybe providers can be more cognizant of it because they've gotten into a routine too. So, any other questions or comments at all? Okay. None? Well, thank you all for, joining us tonight, and we will have this recorded, so if there are others that want to maybe hear about family-centered care, or if you, Mary, if you know anybody that needs any training on family-centered care, we would be more than happy to go out and do that. So
I don't know how many people have hung up, but just to let you know that as you know, spoke about people going and presenting with you, I'm always more than willing to do things like that.
That's great to know, Megan. Thank you. That's awesome. And I'll get you Mo's number, too.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. With that, no further questions, we're going to say good night. So thank you, everybody, for coming on tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.